Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 2012 was a landmark election year for representation of women in the United States Congress. It was the largest number of women ever elected to the Congress. In fact, and it will serve in the 113th Congress, including a record 20 women sent to the U.S. Senate. The story this time is as much about the women's vote, though, as it is about the women elected. Coming up later in the hour, we'll be talking to moderator and managing editor of Washington Week and also PBS NewsHour correspondent Gwen Ifill. But first, to crunch the numbers on the impact of women's votes in 2012 is Kelly Dittmar. She's an assistant research professor at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University. Welcome to the show, Kelly.
Thanks for having me.
So it wasn't so much that women made strides as that the women's votes made strides, especially by helping women-friendly Democrats, I suppose, retain control of the Senate.
Sure. I mean, as usual, we've seen a persistent gender gap in elections over time since 1980. We've seen it at the presidential level, at the Senate level, and lower. But in this race, in 2012, what we saw was in seven of the really most highly visible and competitive Senate races, women's votes were really critical to, in this case, Democrats retaining those seats. And that meant, in turn, that it helped Democrats retain control of the U.S. Senate. So examples like Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin, Sherrod Brown in Ohio, and then, you know, interestingly, though not surprisingly, in states like Missouri and Indiana, where the Republican candidates were out there getting in trouble for some of their comments in relation to women's reproduction and contraception. And so it wasn't surprising to us that those gaps in those races, the gender gaps, were particularly strong.
Was it that women were voting? Well, it's obvious in some cases, but to what extent was it women voting against a candidate and the alternative happened to be a Democrat or a woman?
You know, it's a good question. I think in those cases, in the cases I mentioned where there were explicit comments that really upset women, that was probably likely a push to amplify the gender gap. But what we've seen historically, which I think is probably more true and consistent, is that women just have a tendency to vote Democratic, and they've done so for a long time. And so we just saw a repeat of that in this election. And we were coming off of a swing election for Republicans in 2010, and now in 2012 seeing some sort of gained momentum among Democrats overall. So you'll see that push even more so, again, among women who tend to be Democratic in their ideology and in their vote choice.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Kelly Dittmar. She's an assistant research professor at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University. We're talking about the women's vote. If you have a question or comment for Kelly, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. To what extent are we able to, or are you able to, measure the women's vote, including the women-friendly vote? There's a lot of men out there now that automatically vote the same way a lot of women automatically vote. Do we know?
Do we know how many women are more likely to vote for women?
Or how many men are more likely to vote for women?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've done some surveys over time, though, you know, this is sort of here and there, but about the willingness to vote for a woman candidate. And we see that willingness at 90, 95, 98%. It's a very high percentage. Folks aren't going to sort of come out and say they're unwilling to vote for a woman, though obviously we've seen that increase as more women run, as more women are in office and can sort of prove themselves as obviously apt and qualified candidates and office holders. So I think, interestingly, when we see the gender gap, there are some arguments in some cases, and we've looked at some of these at COP every year. When there is a woman in the race, particularly a woman Democrat, we do see a sort of even larger gap, that there is a certain sort of enthusiasm among women voters for women candidates. But you're right that men are equally enthusiastic if they share the same ideology. And so there is a interaction between the sort of partisan gap and the gender gap.
You mentioned, you know, one of the more outstanding cases, Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin, not only female, beat a very popular former governor of Wisconsin, Tommy Thomas, and but she's also a lesbian.
Yeah.
And I wondered, did that have anything to do with it, or was that just happened to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think Senator Baldwin herself would argue it didn't have a huge effect, but we know that it has an effect sort of on both sides. So that for the number of people that were particularly enthusiastic to see her get into the Senate due to her sexuality, sort of supporters from that community in particular, there was an equal number of folks who were biased against it. And so it's interesting to sort of talk about, in particular, sexuality, but I think we see this with race, ethnicity, religion as well, mm-hmm. where sometimes you can see the effect being swayed both ways, which may, at the end of the day, not necessarily, I don't want to say cancel out, but just plays differently among voters. So obviously, I think it was a factor, and I think there was a particular excitement for her to break another barrier in the U.S. Senate, because we broke a number of them in this election. But again, equally, that also means she had to face some folks who were not so happy about that.
Turnout is a really big deal, and there was concern about turnout, not just, there was talk about it among younger voters, mm-hmm. that they weren't going to turn out in the numbers that they did 4 years ago. There was concern, of course, with the Obama campaign, mm-hmm. And women as well. What was the turnout compared to 4 years ago?
You know, we'll still be looking at, obviously, the real official numbers on turnout when the census numbers come out later in the year. But again, we saw women turning out in larger numbers than men. Again, a historical gap that we've seen over time continue to grow. So we didn't see that enthusiasm lacking in this election that there was some fear early on about. I think in part you could see the in terms of the presidential race, President Obama at the end of the campaign in particular in some of the debates really making an effort there to appeal to women. And that mm-hmm. was obviously fueled by this hope that they would turn out in larger numbers, again, because they veer towards a Democratic vote. On the youth vote, that'll be hard to tell exactly, you know, sort of how the comparison compares to the previous years. We'll still have to sort of parse that out, but I think larger than expected, which is always a benefit, and particularly a benefit in this case to Barack Obama.
Now, New Hampshire made history.
Yes.
First state with all women congressional delegation.
And a chief executive. So.
Right. I mean, that it's, of course, it's a very small state.
Sure.
But it still says something.
Yeah, you know, and I think this election in 2012, you know, in 2010, we saw a year that was fairly depressing for women in politics. We saw the first decline of women at the congressional level that we'd seen since 1979. We saw a 1.2% decline in women in state legislatures. So it was sort of a, you know, the story from 2010 was, gosh, we have a lot of work to do. And I think in 2012, we sort of righted the ship a bit. And included in that was some historical moments that not only were important in their own right, but I think got folks paying attention to women in politics, and also enthusiastic to sort of break more of these barriers. So New Hampshire is one case that's sort of a shining star that we look at as, wow, look how far women have come in New Hampshire. And you're right, the context of New Hampshire is very different. We can talk about that. But, you know, there were other firsts. We had women of color in the Senate. We have now another woman of color in the Senate, which we didn't have. She's only the second, Mazie Hirono. The first, as you mentioned, lesbian women in the Senate as well. Number of barriers broken for women. But, you know, as we always say at the center, we've got a ways to go. So we're still at 18% in the Congress. We're at 20% in the Senate. So we're far from 50%.
Which goes to the whole issue of recruiting women to run for office, and when I started to prepare for this morning, you and I talked before we went on the air. I thought, well, I'm going to check out the White House Project and see what they said about the recruitment of women. And of course, the White House Project, is a organization that was started in 1998. To recruit women to public office, it wasn't a Democrat or a Republican. It was non-denominational, nonpartisan,
sure.
Right? Which went out of business in December.
Sure. And it's always a loss to this community to sort of have a organization like the White House Project that had such particular backing have to close their doors. The good part about that is that the women who are working at the White House Project leadership, like Marie Wilson or Tiffany Dufu, are going to continue on in this fight, and they're going to be helping organizations like ours at the Center for American Women in Politics, other groups like the Women's Campaign Forum, who are doing campaign trainings for women, are out there on the ground trying to recruit women to run, and will continue that work. And so I think their voices will still be a part of the conversation, and we'll continue to do the work with the women's kind of political community to both get women to think about running, which is often the biggest barrier, to just even think that that is possible for them, but then also give them the tools to do so. In 2012, we at the Center for American Women in Politics did a project called the 2012 Project, and it was a particularly targeted effort to get women to take advantage of the electoral opportunity in 2012. That was the redistricting and reapportionment combined with a presidential election year, which meant higher voter turnout, which typically benefited women and Democrats. And so we went state to state, and we brought speakers. We brought formerly elected women, currently elected women, women from these organizations that I mentioned, and brought them into meetings for organizations and classrooms and said, you know, think about running yourself. You're all qualified women, but we don't often turn around and say to ourselves, you should run.
Mm-hmm. So what do you get back what kind of feedback do you get from women about why they're not running?
You know, I think there's a number of factors that we see. One sort of natural problem in the current context is that women look at Washington. They hear the news. They're listening, you know, to your show. I know Ken Rudin was on an hour before. And you hear about the gridlock in Washington, and you say, I don't want to be a part of that. And women in particular, who are problem solvers and who have so long been problem solvers from the outside, both in advocacy, in local PTAs, in volunteer organizations, women have been at the helm and they've been successful. So they don't necessarily see politics, particularly in its current state, as the place where they can get problems solved. And that's unfortunate. And I think we need more women in politics to sort of change that idea. In addition to that, I think reactions for women are different than men in terms of how they make the decision to run. Women look at their family, they look at their personal life, and they say, can I balance these two things? Can I do it? Do I want to make this decision with a family or with other decisions in mind? That's why we see women run later. And men don't do that as much. They often run younger. They have young children, and that's just not the case for women. Case in point, in this election, we sort of looked over all the new women elected. Only one has school-age children. Of men, nearly 50% or more have school-age children of the new men that were elected to the House.
Gail in Clintonville, you're on the air with Kelly Dittmar of the Center for American Women in Politics.
Hello. First, I'd like to preface my comments. I heard her mention the 2010 election. I heard a very depressing statistic that only like 35% of Ohio women voted in 2010, and that's why we got a Republican majority that gerrymandered the heck out of the state. Second of all, I would like to talk about the program that was on Tuesday called The Makers. It was on PBS on Tuesday, which was a great program. The thing that that bothered me was when they, you know, because they interviewed a couple of mother and daughter people on there, and the thing that troubled me was some of the younger women that were interviewed, I'm not sure if I consider myself a feminist or not. And, you know, I think they have the feeling that it doesn't matter if they get politically involved because they've already arrived. They've already reaped the benefits of what we went through. I mean, you know, I came up in the 70s with consciousness-raising groups and whatnot. But I have the feeling that, you know, if they don't get on the stick and pay attention, that they're going to lose everything that we fought for. Because I mean, look at the way the reproductive, clinics, women's mm-hmm. clinics, all over the country are being shut down one after another.
Well, that's one thing, but politics is a little bit different. Kelly, what about that though? That youth, the female youth, younger female vote.
Sure. You know, I think there's two responses to that question, and thank you for the question. First, this idea that sort of young people, I wouldn't even say just young women, are sort of desensitized to some of this, that's the idea that we've made it. That is something that we worry about and we see in general, where folks will look at a Hillary Clinton, a Condoleezza Rice, they look on the news and to a Nancy Pelosi, and they say, well, women in politics have made it. They're at the upper realms of politics and they're doing well. Mm-hmm. That hides the numbers. So that is a problem that we see sometimes. But I think in terms of younger women, and the idea of sort of turning away from politics, I'm not sure that younger women are turning away from politics. I think younger women are getting enthused and angry and are engaged in advocacy. But again, the problem that we see, and this is not new, is that women and young women look to advocacy as the way to get things done. And they may be advocates on health care, on any other issue. It doesn't have to be quote-unquote feminist issues in their perspective. But we need to go to those women and say, you're advocating for these issues, you're fighting for these issues, but you know where you can get some really significant change done? That's in the institutional government. That's in Congress. That's in your city council and your state legislature. So making that turn for young women from thinking about advocacy and public service to public service in elected office is one that we have to work on.
Kelly Dittmar, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kelly Dittmar, she's an assistant research professor at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University. Coming up, Gwen Ifill. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and sustaining givers are the future of our station. A sustainer gives a fixed amount each month. For example, $5, $10, or even $20 per month can be charged to your credit card. Then your membership is always active, your member card renews automatically, and we can send less mail reminding you it's time to give. Visit wosu.org/sustainer and sign up today. 33 degrees in downtown Columbus, some snow for today and a rain-snow mix later on, a high of 37. Light snow for tonight, a low of 27 degrees. Support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is now accepting donations of used computers to be refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. AT Ohio offers a variety of disability programs and services, including a device loan library. Donation information is at atohio.org. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We've been discussing the progress of women in government and politics. Joining us now, Gwen Ifill, senior correspondent for the PBS NewsHour and managing editor and moderator of Washington Week. On PBS, she'll be giving the keynote address at a meeting of the Women for Economic and Leadership Development on March 21st. You can get more information at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Welcome to the show, Gwen.
Hi, Ann.
So we established in the previous segment the impact that women voters had on the 2012 election outcomes across the country. And in a December blog, you wrote about the impact that women could have on Congress going forward. But it started out with Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins saying, if women were in charge, things would be different now regarding the budget deal. There's always a lot of ifs still.
Yeah, there are a lot of ifs, but because the fact of the matter is in both houses of Congress, we're only talking about 19% of women, even though we're at record numbers. And the question is not just being there, but also being in a leadership position to make the change happen. Even with men running things, sometimes it's hard to get anything done in Washington. So she may have been overstating a little bit, but about whether gender would make a difference, because Washington has bigger problems.
Mm-hmm. And Kelly Dittmar did mention that when you're looking from out at it from the outside, it can be a little bit of a turnoff the way Washington tends to operate.
You know, Kelly is exactly right. It's funny, when I was working, I guess it's been four years, I was working on a book about breakthrough among black elected officials, and everywhere I went around the country, inevitably someone would say, well, what about women? When is the breakthrough going to happen with women? And I had that same thought, too, when I was reporting on the book. I thought, why is it that none of the people I was profiling for this, none of the African Americans I was profiling were women? So I started asking about that, and I went to Rutgers, among other places, to ask the question, and I got exactly the same answers that Kelly was talking about. A lot of women sit there and think to themselves, I can lead in other ways that don't involve calling up people and asking for money and running thankless races. I can lead in public service, or I can lead in nonprofit, the nonprofit world. And among those who do get into politics, it's different, and it's more complicated, and it's distasteful in some ways. A lot of women want to get into leadership for different reasons. And very importantly, the women we can point to as being the most accomplished, the Nancy Pelosi's and the Hillary Clinton's of the world, none of them decided to get into real, flat out, run for the top politics until after their children were grown and out of the House. Nancy Pelosi was a grandmother when she became Speaker of the House. And as a result, we have a kind of a different drive that brings women into politics.
It's interesting when you say, I can lead in other ways. You know, that's what women used to say before they even had the vote, mm-hmm. before they could own their own property. That's when a lot of our social service agencies were started.
That's right.
You know, and they were very successful there.
Well, there's also a matter of choice. Just because you can doesn't mean you want to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a lot of women who, no matter how you look at it, you still have to have the flexibility to do more than one thing. We haven't quite seemed to have reached the point yet where women are not the main keepers together of the home and the house and the primary caregivers for the children. And I know a lot of women who don't want it to be any other way. They like being primary caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
They just want to have the choice to do more than that if they choose.
My guest this hour, Gwen Ifill, senior correspondent for the PBS NewsHour and managing editor and moderator of Washington Week on PBS. If you have a question for Gwen, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you can also post a question or comment for Gwen on our Facebook page. At a conference you wrote about recently, it was filled with powerful women and everyone from activist philanthropist Abigail Disney to a slew of corporate big shots. For them, the key word was inclusion as opposed to diversity. What's the distinction there?
The distinction is that the word, every now and then we overuse words and terms to the point that they're devalued. And the word diversity has now come loaded. People think diversity means diversity for its own sake rather than to accomplish a goal. So these women in this group are starting to talk, a lot of powerful women are starting to talk instead about inclusion, making sure we're at the table, making sure our points of view are represented rather than just being there. Over the years, someone on the last call mentioned this PBS program, The Makers, which aired this week. I watched mm-hmm. that too. And it was clear that in the early years of the women's movement, it was a big deal just to be in the room, just to get there, just to be allowed in. But now, 20, 25, 30 years later, the question is impact. And impact is where inclusion comes in. And it means that once one woman gets in the room, she's got to bring other women in with her so that they have a shared impact instead of just being there. If a woman rises to power and doesn't do anything for other women, progress just ends there. Part of the debate this week about what Marissa Meyer at Yahoo did in saying that telecommuting should end came about because a lot of women were resentful that a woman would remove a perk which seemed to benefit a lot of stay-at-home mothers. And I don't know that that's why she did it. That's not why she said she did it. But mm-hmm. that's where the debate immediately went. So we're still at this point, as we always are at the beginning of movements, where, or even the midpoint at movements, where you're trying to figure out what it means to be in the room. And I think inclusion is a more all-encompassing goal than just diversity for its own sake.
Oh, you know, 20-odd years ago when I was first covering the Ohio General Assembly, there were actually more women there than there are now, or aren't very many more now than there were then. And it was impossible to conceive of that 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we thought, well, look at how many there are now, and there'll be at least twice as many. And it couldn't be farther from that. But what has changed a lot in 20 years is the number of women in the boardrooms. It's still very low. But the number of women at these these kinds of conferences that you spoke at, that you were blogging about, you know, the corporate people, that's changed a lot.
That has changed a lot. But I also think there's been a lot of other change. I mean, I look at the state of New Hampshire, which now has an all-women's delegation, the governor, the representatives, the senators. Everybody is a woman. That didn't happen by accident. And New Hampshire is not your most liberal state in the union, so something was happening there. And you look around, and you can find even examples of what we used to call, and still I suppose, call the gender gap, and the effect it has on elections, which are not necessarily about the representation. We're still electing men, but by 18 points, Barack Obama won more women than Mitt Romney did, and he was the winner. That was he only got a 12-point gender gap advantage in 2008. So women's involvement may not necessarily be limited to being in office or being in high corporate corner offices. It may be being involved and engaged.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Gwen Ifill of PBS. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I mentioned earlier Abigail Disney was in the room at that conference you spoke at, and she did a documentary on Liberian women's fight for peace. It was called Pray the Devil Back to Hell. Mm-hmm. And I remember that documentary so well because of the women. The men were trying to get something resolved, and it finally was the women standing outside refusing to move.
Exactly. She told that story at the conference,
just embarrassing the men.
But isn't that what we do? No matter what the situation is. I mean, think about Rosa Parks, whose statue was unveiled at the Capitol yesterday. What did she do in the end? She refused to move.
Right.
I think in the end, sometimes change isn't just by storming the doors. Change comes from holding your ground as well.
Yeah, the Rosa Parks, it's 100 years now, would have been, it was the 100-year anniversary of her birth. It does make you think. It isn't an interesting, the statue as well was interesting. It was that kind of refuse to move kind of a statue.
And the fact that the statue was of her seated was very interesting to me, and I'm sure it worked out with her family and with her survivors and her fans.
Mm-hmm.
But also what's really interesting to me about what happened with the Rosa Parks case is, you know, we loved when we talk about women who break through, we don't much like women who get in your face. We don't much like women who are aggressive, and we don't really celebrate women who are loud or misbehave. But instead, you look at – so as a result, over the years – there's a woman named Jean Theroux Harris who wrote a book called The Rebellious Life of Rosa Parks. And people thought, really? Rebellious? What are you talking about? Actually, the proper title was The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. She gave her the honorific because she felt so often black women had that honorific taken away from them as a way of shrinking who they were. But Rosa Parks didn't get to that bus in Montgomery by deciding to be demure. She got to it by training and learning how to work on behalf of voters' rights. But for her story to catch hold and catch the nation's imagination in 1955, she had to be portrayed as someone who was just tired and wouldn't get up, when it was clearly more than that. And the rest of her life proved that. So we have found ways and ways to break through, women have, over the years. And it often has as much to do with how you speak than whether you speak.
When I've talked about the March on Washington, of course, the 50th anniversary is coming up this year. It's kind of bittersweet if you care about women and their role in it, because even though they helped put it on, they weren't even allowed on the stage, except for, of course, Mahalia Jackson, who sang.
I talked to Dorothy Hyde about that once before she died. She is a perfect example of a woman who had a very strong behind the scenes role. A lot of the 1960s civil rights movement, but when the time came for the pictures to be taken, she was nowhere to be seen, and that happened to people like Diane Nash, who led these freedom rides. You never heard about them until years later, when their contributions were unearthed by people, authors like Taylor Branch and Henry Hampton and Eyes on the Prize. And then you began to find out, oh, wow, this was a women's movement even then. But for some reason, race and gender will always clash.
Was it just old-fashioned sexism?
I think sometimes it's not sexism or racism. I think that often it's just somebody wants to be celebrated, and that person will not allow you to be celebrated, too. You don't get to share the stage. Does that make sense? I mean, I think it's often when I find that people say the most crazy things to me or insulting things, it has very little to do with me. It has to do with where they are. So maybe the men needed to occupy the pulpit, and there was no room for anybody else up there, and certainly not the women who were there. Were basically asking to bring their dinner.
Do you think that that decision and any kind of resulting bitterness affected the trajectory of the civil rights movement in any way, particularly?
I don't think so, because African-American women were incredibly loyal to the movement to the point that they were skeptical of the feminism movement because they thought they were being asked to make a choice between their families and their gender, and they were always going to choose being their gender, except with the notable exception of Shirley Chisholm, who said she had suffered more from being a woman than she ever did from being black, which I would add had a lot more to do with her West Indian heritage, which I also share, than probably her skin color. Even so, I think in the end, the movement didn't stop because women didn't get their due at the stop. They were still there loyally pushing behind the scenes, almost happily pushing behind the scenes for a larger goal.
You pointed out as well in that blog that a generation of new voters had never seen a white man as a Secretary of State. And I've heard it, you know, before, too, but it's always kind of interesting to think about it in those terms.
It does pull you up short. And I had an opportunity not long ago to talk to Madeleine Albright, who is, of course, was a former Secretary of State. And one of the things she talked about, we talked about, was this whole issue that, you know, who would have thought that all these years between, that not since Caspar Weinberger had there been a white man between now and John Kerry, that we'd had Colin Powell and that we'd had Condoleezza Rice, that it was kind of a remarkable time to see Hillary Clinton, of course, and Madeleine Albright. It's kind of a remarkable thing to see. But ultimately, I think that Americans on some levels have gotten used to seeing women in so many different venues that they don't debate it among themselves anymore. It becomes who is the individual who is up there. When Elizabeth Warren was running against Scott Brown in Massachusetts and I covered that race, people didn't come up to me and saying, I'm voting for Scott Brown because I don't like that woman, even though I'm sure there are some people who may have felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I think that we've come a great distance, which is kind of good to see. You know, I'm sitting here talking to you, Anna, by the way, and I'm keeping one eye on television, which is showing live photographs of the Pope leaving the Vatican and going to Castel Gandolfo to begin his retirement, his kind of unprecedented retirement. And somewhere in that crowd are a lot of women who wonder why women don't have a say in who his replacement is. You know, this debate continues and continues.
My guest is Gwen Ifill, senior correspondent for PBS NewsHour, moderator and managing editor of Washington Week on PBS. She will stay with us for the next segment. If you have a question or comment for Gwen, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll get to those emails and calls when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
After spending years battling Palestinian militants and hunting down terrorists, six former Israeli intelligence chiefs question their country's rule of the occupied territories in the Oscar-nominated documentary The Gatekeepers. On the next Fresh Air, director Dror Moreh tells us about making that film and his profile of former Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. 33 degrees with some light snow. Expect a rain-snow mix today, a high of 37. A chance of some snow tonight, a low of 27 degrees. And join All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow for a look at the condition of Asperger syndrome and the decision to recategorize it as autistic. And then WOSU News host Marilyn Smith joins us for a discussion of the best food and restaurants in Central Ohio. That's All Sides from 10 to noon on Friday on 89.7 NPR News. Support comes from Ohio State's Department of Neurology, conducting a planned emergency study to see if progesterone can limit the effects of a traumatic brain injury, or TBI. Details on the PROTECT study include a community opinion survey and how to opt out of the study are at protect.ohio.gov. iii.com. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Gwen Ifill, senior correspondent for the PBS NewsHour and moderator and managing editor of Washington Week on PBS. She will return, or she will be in Columbus on March 21st to give the keynote address for the Women for Economic and Leadership Development. For more information on that event, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Gwen, we have an email from Barb. She asks, what do you make of President Obama's selection of top staff members and the lack of women? What are your thoughts about the cabinet now and whose names were missing that you thought should have been there?
Well, I think the selection of the cabinet is still a work in progress. What I'm always interested in watching cabinets get put together, no matter who's doing it, is who is going to be there and what actual import they have. For instance, he had Lisa Jackson at the Department of the Environmental Protection Agency, but you could argue that a lot of the goals that she had in mind, especially about emissions control, didn't actually fit with what the administration and the White House had in mind, and so they didn't happen. She's leaving after one term to go do other things, but you look at people like Hilda Solis, who's leaving, and of course Hillary Clinton, and they're what they were able to accomplish was all over the map. But what was more interesting to me about what happened with the president's cabinet at large was how much of what the president's priorities were got run out of the White House and not out of cabinet departments at all. So we love the window dressing of having a cabinet that looks like America, as Bill Clinton used to say. But the real test is what happens after they get there.
Kathy and Hilliard, you're on the air with Gwen Ifill. Welcome.
Thank you, and thanks for taking my call. Gwen, thank you for all that you do for the women's movement through your competence. You're just a fantastic spokesman for women.
Thank you, Kathy.
I was just going to ask about your perspective on history of the women's movement. I've just gotten started these last few years in getting more involved, and I've been struck at how, as I learn more about things such as the abolitionist movement and how women were so active in that and then found their own strength and their own voice through that, and then the women's suffrage and the people that stood up for women's rights and were enslaved or put into prison and such, were just so inspiring to me, and things that I hadn't really focused on until I got involved in the women's movement. And I wondered if you see any inspiration in that kind of history.
Well, it's funny because this year we were paying so much attention to the past in our fiction, going to see Lincoln and movies like that.
Uh-huh.
And so many people realized afterward, commented afterward, that only part of the story was told. The story of the abolitionist was told, this is not a plug because I had nothing to do with it, but with the PBS special, The Abolitionist, which did capture the roles of what women did, and Frederick Douglass. And it wasn't like, if you watched Lincoln, you thought that through the passage of a law that as the slaves passively sat by, somehow America became its better self. But in fact, it becomes its better self, whether it's about suffrage or about emancipation, when the actual affected people rise up and speak. And that's what happened in each of these cases. And that's what many women got belated attention for. The women are not passive. Women were not bystanders in all these moments in history, and we've come slowly around to it, but we're getting there. What I find more interesting than almost talking about the past is talking about the future and talking to young women who have been exposed to these stories in a limited way. And so when you see a documentary like The Makers the other night, I think that was news for a lot of women about how this came about. There had never been a full-length documentary done on the women's movement ever. And this was 3 hours long, and it was fascinating. But I think for a lot of women, young women especially, this was brand new news. So we can never stop telling the stories. That's kind of what we have to do.
Thanks a lot, Kathy, for that call. If you'd like to speak with Gwen Ifill, the number is 614-292-8513. Republicans are having some heart-to-heart talks with each other these days, and a division has emerged since the November election. It's been well reported. In Virginia now, a solidly purple state, I guess, Republicans are putting forth a gubernatorial candidate with solidly conservative credentials. Definitely issues that women take issue or points of view that women take issue with. It's surprising at this point that not that the Republicans are putting forth a candidate that might be conservative, but one that may be so objectionable to women after what they went through in November.
Well, you know, I'm actually watching today the House vote on the Violence Against Women Act, which everybody would have thought was kind of a slam dunk for reauthorization, if only because of its title. I mean, who would be against, be for violence against women? But in fact, it had gotten really hung up for a while, and there was some question about whether it was going to be reauthorized. But this is one of those cases where the Republican leadership came to their senses and looked around and thought, what kind of a hit will we take? What will the ads run against us look like in 2014 and 2016 if we can be accused of having stopped this? So the Republican Eric Cantor is from Virginia, actually spoke up, and he's the House Majority Leader, I think is his title. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, we can't do this. This would be self-inflicted wound. So the House is poised to approve this, which is a direct outcome of having looked at what happened in the election and the numbers and what is likely to happen again and coming to their senses and not having unnecessary fights about things they may disagree with. There are a lot of things which are just policy disagreements. The one thing I don't agree with is the idea that people vote against the president or against Democrats or against Republicans because of personality issues. There are sometimes real policy differences, and the argument can be made that the leadership is in sticking to your guns when it comes to a policy difference. But there is also political reality, and on issues in which you don't really differ, you have to decide whether it's worth picking that fight.
Right. And does it concern you? Are you troubled that this doesn't really bother us, so let's just go forward with it and not make politics out of it when it comes to that kind of issue?
You know what? I'm probably giving it too easy a backhand way of describing what their decision making was. But you know what? That's how sausage gets made. That's how policy gets made. That's how laws get made. I mean, the one thing they did get right that I kind of liked in Lincoln was they did talk about how horse trading in the end is what got this thing done. And often that's what happens. So I'm not really so concerned with how you get to it. I just wish people could get to it more often, with more alacrity.
When I first learned about log rolling in grade school, it seemed so simple back then. And now even the idea of log rolling and actually doing it, it seems horrible, and it makes more sense. 614-292-8513. Get the calls in now if you want to speak with Gwen Ifill. The Washington Post, Dana Milbank, yesterday wrote about another arena where women still are the minority gender but are gaining steam, and that is the U.S. Supreme Court. He said that for the first time in many years, a couple members of the court are willing to face down Justice Antonin Scalia, the longest serving member, and those two happen to be women.
It's interesting. I interviewed Justice Sotomayor last week for the NewsHour. And
the newest member.
Well, she's the second to member.
Right.
Elena Kagan's the newest.
That's right.
But she's only been on the court 3.5 years. And it was so interesting. She wouldn't talk that much about, obviously, what the deliberations are. But her actions on the bench are what's worth looking at. She, first of all, is very keenly aware that she is not only the one of three women on the court, including Justice Ginsburg, but she also is very much aware that she represents a point of view and a worldview that nobody else in the court brings. She was raised in a household where they didn't speak English as a first language. She came from the Bronx, lived in the high-rise projects. She is very clear that her background is not the privileged background of everyone else there, and therefore she speaks for that. So as a result, yesterday we had arguments over the reauthorization of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Law, which forces certain states to have to check with the federal government before they can redistrict or change voting rules because of a history of discrimination. And the argument was that there should be that this is the federal government intruding on a state like, in this case, Alabama. And somewhere along the course of the argument, Justice Antonin Scalia made the point that this was, and his exact phrasing is going to escape me, I regret, But he made the case that this was preferential treatment to have to punish these certain states this way. And it was Sonia Sotomayor who really questioned it, who really didn't get in his face, because they never do that really on the bench, but who challenged whether that's what this was. And this is one of those cases where you'd love to be in the meeting they have afterward, after everyone goes away,
right,
and hear what kind of discussions they have. So, but Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor clearly feel that their role there is very specific. They're not just there to, the phrase that Justice Scalia used was racial entitlement. He called it a perpetuation of racial entitlement. And that's where Justice Sotomayor spoke up. Women in these roles, and Justice O'Connor, who was the first woman on the court, was also part of this documentary the other night. She was always very conscious of the fact that she had brought a specific point of view to the court. At the time she was on the court, she's also the only person who's ever been in an elected office. So she brought a political sensibility that often got overlooked as well. So it matters that we're there. It matters that we're part of the conversation. And then it matters what we think our role should be in the conversation.
And yet you still have women and men or any stripe of person who may represent a minority or a special interest group who says, you know, I wasn't elected because of this. I have other people that I represent too.
That's true. And that's perfectly fine. I mean, that's Justice Thomas's argument.
Mm-hmm.
And Justice Thomas doesn't feel the need to represent Black people or people from Pinpoint, Georgia, or people who went to Yale, all of which he is. He doesn't feel the need to represent beneficiaries of affirmative action, which he also is. And that's fine. Nobody should feel they have to. But for women, I think that the choices, it seems more often that a woman feels she has to speak to that. And Justice O'Connor is a good example. It's not driven by party necessarily.
What about the idea that they're not afraid to stand up to him? I think the way Milbank put it, as it happens, the two manning up to take on Nino the Terrible are women, the court's newest members. you know, as you said, Sotomayor and, of course, Elena Kagan.
It's a lovely idea. I'm not certain the fights are always that clear cut. And, in fact, the justices are so courteous to one another in general that I can't imagine there are fist fights behind the scenes.
Rachel in Clintonville, you're on the air with Gwen Ifill. Welcome.
Hi. I wanted to ask about, you had talked about the legislation that passed regarding violence against women, and I was just wondering, Gwen, what do you think can be done outside of legislation in terms of when we're challenging things like rape culture and how that has psychological impact on girls, on boys even, and thinking about how that informs gendered relations, what can we be doing to address those sorts of things?
Rachel, I wish I knew the answer to your question. I have to say, I still think of myself basically as a reporter who shows up and describes what I see rather than an advocate who tells you what we ought to do. So, yes, as individuals and as mothers of children and sisters and women in general, we should be having these conversations, and we should take every opportunity we can as individuals to speak to that. But as a society, I lean away from prescribing societal solutions for problems. And I'm much more comfortable, I guess, waiting to see how it unfolds, because that's where history is made and that's where what I'm kind of here to cover.
Thanks, Rachel, for that call. We still have a few minutes left with Gwen Ifill. So if you want to get your call in, 614-292-8513. Gwen, despite the election results and the voting numbers of women, a very small percentage of women still are willing to enter the category of candidate themselves. I talked about it earlier, with Kelly Dittmar of the Center for American Women in Politics. And when I went to the White House Project website to get the numbers on that, as I often will, I learned that the White House Project had closed its doors, it was founded in 1998 by Marie Wilson, and the idea was to enhance public perception of women as leaders and fill our nation's leadership pipeline. I know people are still taking on the yoke of that, but what do we do when women don't want to run?
It's an excellent question. You know, I think if you ask Marie Wilson, and I haven't talked to her since the White House Project closed down, I don't think that she would tell you that she failed at her goal. Mm-hmm. I think she probably could tell you that she actually did quite well at achieving what she set out to achieve in raising awareness and getting more women engaged in public life. But I also don't think it's necessarily a defeat when women don't choose elective office as a path to leadership, partly because a lot of men aren't choosing it either. The truth is, right now, there's elective office is suffering from kind of a bigger problem, which is they don't do themselves any favor every time everything looks like horse trading, everything looks like money, everything looks like trade-offs, when in fact people who want to lead are discouraged from getting involved in that kind of a fight often. So, if people in general are discouraged, then women are likely to be more discouraged. Mm. But I don't know any young women I talk to who feel like they can't do it if they want to. And the difference between what is true now and what was true 30 years ago, 40 years ago, was that he couldn't. There was no way in. Now there's a way in. You have a choice to do it, whether you think that's the best use of your advocacy or not. And that's what I don't think we know the answer to yet, whether women are just choosing other ways to do this or whether women are just discouraged.
We have an email from Mary. She makes a point about she says, here's what I'd like to see from women who are involved in politics. Work to rewrite, reshape the political arena as we know it. Our current political format is obviously male-created, one of competition, winners and losers, gamesmanship, small tactics, and manipulation, which goes back to that conversation we were having earlier about back when women didn't have the vote, when they didn't have property, they did other things. They started organizations that persist today. Mm-hmm. The YWCA, all the different organizations that have now been institutionalized by government, children's services, and so forth.
No, absolutely. And once again, I don't think that's a bad way of going about it. It certainly has mm-hmm. proven over time that it's a useful way. The goal, I think, in all of this kind of advocacy for inclusion is make the path possible, not force people into the path. Make it possible. If I decided I wanted to be a leader, I can. I'm in journalism because I hope that I won't be the last woman in my job doing that my example will make people want to do it, will open the door wider and wider with each generation. That doesn't mean that if you don't do it, we failed, or if you've chosen another path, we failed. In fact, maybe we've broadened the options, and that is its own victory.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting this year during the election cycle in the fall. There was almost as much chit-chat about who moderated the big presidential debates as there was about who was the host of the Academy Awards.
You know, but the chit-chat, the difference with the Academy Awards is people were still chit-chatting about it after it was over. Whereas at the debates, the moment the debate ended, you stopped talking about the moderators. I moderated two debates, and I'm here to tell you that there's always a lot of pressure leading up to it on the moderator, partly because it's possible you're trying to game the ref, and that's both sides are trying to do that, and partly because there's nothing else to talk about until you see the candidate on the stage. But once the candidates get on the stage and actually stand there side by side and voters begin to be able to make their own assessments, who's asking the questions really fades quite quickly. So it's fine. We're in an environment now where we talk about everything. We chat about everything. We pull it apart. We put it back together. But in the end, voters didn't go into the booth on November 6th and say, gee, I wonder what Candy Crowley would do. I don't think they thought that. I think they just thought, what do I need to do and how is this going to affect my life?
Gwen Ifill, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was fun.
Gwen Ifill is the senior correspondent for PBS NewsHour, a moderator and managing editor of Washington Week on PBS. She'll be in Columbus on March 21st. To learn more about that, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. And thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producers Corinne Gleckler, Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Shaban, Rose Joe. And to Rose Joe, thank you so much for all of your support and help, Rose, and best luck in the future at Northwestern University. And also Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening again. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.